My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics may participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it will also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature person, Destina and Coble, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you learn here. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and your understanding. Susan S. will read the preamble.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Susan. Hi. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Dennis C. will read the steps.
My name is Dennis Caron. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such persons wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Please join in a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity. Maria D. will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Maria. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, the 12 traditions. One. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Mike S.
Hi, my name is Mike and I am an alcoholic. Just want to thank you, Chris, for asking me to speak. I find it to be an honor and a privilege to be alive and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today because, as far as I'm concerned, I should be dead. You know, before the meeting today, we were, a group of friends were, and I were going over steps 10, 11, and 12. And if you're new, I didn't walk into these rooms with a group of friends. You know, I don't know how it happened. I mean, I could try to explain it to you, but it's really on the basis of my relationship with a power greater than myself. And it's really that simple because I have nothing else besides that. What it was like, I grew up in a very strict household, and my parents were not alcoholics. They never drank around us. And, you know, I just grew up with a sense of not belonging, like not knowing, you know, where I fit into this world. You know, I always thought that people had it more together than I did. I always felt that for me to match their lives or their manageability, I had to be perfect. And for me to be perfect is just, it's not possible, you know. And, you know, I was always chasing after something that just wasn't possible. And, you know, it just threw me basically into a pit of despair because I had no foundation for life. You know, I had religion, you know, and what religion gave me was a basic framework for what I call my higher power today. But, you know, I like my higher power much better now than I did then. You know, and when I started drinking, it was, you know, I was chasing that same thing, you know, trying to chase that thing that was unattainable. You know, I got it after that first drink, I wouldn't say after, but after the first drunk, I felt that sense of belonging and that, you know, that I fit into this world. And from then on, I chased it. I chased it to the ends of the earth. And I never got it again. And it led to all sorts of unmanageability. My, you know, normal drinkers could have like 2 or 3 drinks and then they say, you know, I'm drunk, I think I'm going to stop. You know, that confused me. When someone said they were going to stop, it really made me angry at the first part because how dare you stop drinking in front of me? You know, I came here to drink. I came here to get drunk. You can't stop drinking. And it was really just, it just didn't make any sense to me. Normal drinkers, like I said, have 2 or 3 drinks and go home. You know, I drank and I woke up in a trunk of a car, you know. Normal drinkers don't do that. That was, you know, I blacked out a whole lot, you know. I went to, you know, I didn't start drinking until later on in high school, and in the beginning it was manageable. You know, I was, you know, I wasn't getting in trouble. I could talk to women. I could do all sorts of things. But you know, then came college, and all bets were off after college because I was free. You know, I didn't have to basically be accountable to anybody, and you know. I went to a college in the Bronx called the Maritime Academy, and, you know, I didn't learn anything there except how to drink. And, you know, what I found out in the Bronx is that there are these things called bodegas. And if you were at the Sunday night meeting, you heard Amanda share about this, but, you know, that was my source of fuel, were basically 40-ounce beers, and I like 64s better because they had more in it. And you know, I only had to buy two or three of them, and you know, again, normal drinkers don't buy two or three 64 ounces of malt liquor, and expect to finish them in one night. Also, you know, the unmanageability of my drinking led me to not eating. You know, I figured I'll just drink instead of eat because you know I don't have the money to eat, so I'll just drink. And in Bill's story, he says how he was 40 pounds underweight. I wouldn't say I was 40 pounds, but I was basically a skeleton, and I didn't think anything was wrong. I thought this is what you did. This is how people drink. You know, you just go out and you get blasted. And that was the basis of my life for a long, long time. And, I decided I didn't want to go to college anymore, so I failed out, you know, beyond my parents' consent. And, you know, because they wouldn't let me leave, so I just took matters into my own hand, and I went into the workforce. And what I do for a living is, you know, I do repairs on elevators. And to be drunk and to be fixing elevators at the same time isn't a very good idea. But that's what I did. You know, I would stand on top of elevators spinning, basically. And, you know, by this point, I was just suicidal. I wanted to die, and but I was just too afraid to do it. And the only thing that would stop me, thank you, the only thing that would stop me from that is booze. Booze stopped me from killing myself a lot of times. And I'll just quickly, you know, when I was out there, I didn't believe in humanity. I thought humanity was God's greatest mistake, and I thought that humanity didn't have the capacity to love. But the one thing that did, that I thought made up for it was animals, and I always had pets. And one night I decided that it was more important for me to drink than to take care of an animal. And it was a hot August night, and, you know, thunderstorms were coming, and the dog was going crazy, and I decided I needed to drink. So, you know, cut it short, the dog, you know, died of heat stroke. And that's when it hit me. Something's wrong. You know, it had to take a death of a living thing for me to be like, oh, well, maybe I have a problem with my drinking. But that didn't stop me. I drank for a couple more weeks, and by the grace of God, I got in contact with someone who was in the rooms, and I went to my first meeting. My first meeting was the 11:30 morning meeting of the Mustard Seed, and, you know, Jim spoke here a few weeks ago, talked about how, you know, when you walk into an AA room, you know, one of the slogans, I think he said, should be, the war's over, you lost, you know, and that's how I felt when I walked into the Mustard Seed, because, you know, it's a dark room, and there's the steps and traditions, and I'm like, what happened? How did this happen? But I knew deep down in my heart that I just couldn't do it anymore. I was finished, and I knew if I went back out, I probably wouldn't come back. You know, and I got a sponsor in the Atlantic Group, and his name was Raphael. He moved down to Florida, and I'm forever grateful to him because he took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, he helped me clear away the wreckage of the past. And, you know, that is essential for me. You know, if you're new and this is all sounding weird, you know, just stay here. You'll get there. The most, you know, I need to keep my side of the street clean today so that I can have a relationship with God, and it comes down to that, and that's it. I go to meetings. I do lots of service because, you know, the only way I got to know people was by doing service. I didn't, you know, I have very limited social skills, and, you know, doing service helped me break through that, and Chris will attest to this. You know, I had about 10 days, and I went to the Atlantic Group picnic, And, you know, people were not a thing that I wanted to be around. So there was definitely a tree there that was my best friend. You know, I just hung on to that tree for dear life for a good hour. And I was, you know, that was a lot for me. You know, I couldn't be around people. But today I have such a beautiful network of people around me. And Kevin H. spoke here a few months ago speaking. He said how... you're going to meet Jesuses and Buddhas in human form here. And I truly believe that. I truly believe that I've come in contact with a lot of spiritual giants. And I stick to what they say because I know what I tell myself is no good. I have to listen to what they tell me. And, you know, if they tell me to sweep the streets of New York City, I do it. Because I know that's what they're looking out for my interest. And that's not something I had before. Before I came in here, I had nothing. I was miserable. I was alone. I just wanted to die. And I just, today I have a design for living. I have, you know, I mean, days are not perfect. And, you know, I can be unmanageable, but I call my sponsor and I call other alcoholics and they give me direction. That's all I need is direction. You know, I don't need a, you know, that's all I need is direction, you know, and, I just practice. One of the most important things I do each day, and to end this, is that I meditate in the morning because I need to clear my head of all this craziness. And the God of my understanding comes to me every day without fail. It doesn't abandon me. If you know you, God, this higher power will never, ever abandon you. It's here, and it will take care of you no matter what. And just to end this, you know, I'll take what Stacy said once. Just show up. No matter what happens in your life, just show up and it gets better and your life, you have a life beyond your wildest dreams. And like I said, I should be dead and I have a life. And that's just a miracle. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Deanna.
Hi, I'm Deanna, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be sober. I just celebrated my 15-year anniversary. And I say that because I am going to focus on my recovery, because I think that the ups and downs and the all-arounds of my recovery really illuminate my life more than what it was before. I earned my seat here in a very big way. I lost my family. I lost my marriage. I lost my career. And I pretty much almost lost myself. I didn't lose a lot of my belongings. I was lucky. But when I came in, I was sent to treatment. And luckily, I never picked anything up after that. When I first came in, the only thing I was concerned about was how to get my husband back, or how am I going to be taken care of, and how I'm going to survive. I had no connection between what was upstairs and what was in my heart at all. I was frantically scurrying around trying to just get by. I think I had a tremendously low bottom physically. At the end, for the last 6 months, I'd been drinking around the clock. I probably drank about a quart of hard liquor a day plus a bottle or two of wine. And I was shaking. I was sweating in the middle of winter. It was pretty bad. I'm losing my train of thought, but I come from a family that my parents were European, and they spoke with a heavy accent, and I come from the Midwest, and all I wanted back then was to be a normal American kid that assimilated, and that's exactly what I wasn't, because the minute my parents opened their mouths, people knew that I was from somewhere else. So I started drinking when I went to college. And I thought it was fun, it was social, and it was. I never had one drink. It was fun, so you sort of get high, you get drunk, whatever. when I finished graduate school, I thought, okay, now that I am a professional, what do you do after you come home from work? You have cocktails. And so my habit became daily very, very quickly. And it was the sophisticated thing to do, to go out with people after work and have drinks. And then I thought, well, if I wasn't going out with people, I drank at home. I mean, that's pretty sophisticated, you know, have wine, you know, cigarettes, and just this would go on and on and on. And probably within 3 months, I had crossed the line. But I knew nothing about alcoholism. My parents were doctors, and to them, they were medical doctors. To them, alcoholics were in the Bowery. So I kind of had the same thought. All I wanted was a good time. My career was sort of, you know, the whole objective was to go out there and have fun. I moved to New York, and I went to work on Wall Street. And again, the huge objective was to go and have fun, and I did. I met somebody, and it was a very nice person, and we got married, and his whole wish for me was do whatever makes you happy. At which point, I lost my job, and it was summertime, and what made me totally happy was to drink morning, noon, and night, and to just relax, because I had been very stressed. So I got married to this wonderful person, and my life should have been blossoming. Instead, it started little by little caving in on me. And I started drinking a lot, more and more and more, to the point that he would say, "Don't you think you've had enough?" Which would, I would go into a rage. And when I was at home and this would happen, it wasn't a problem because I would stay in the kitchen and cook and clean all night. Not a big kitchen, but it's what I did. And I would hide wine glasses behind the toilet. And this continued on and on and on. When we would go on trips, I sort of had to watch it. But I remember on one of our last trips, I actually went to the liquor store and I bought booze and I hid it in my suitcase. And I don't know, I kind of sensed that something was off. Husband said he's going to leave. I was like, good, now I can drink. Last 6 months, I drank around the clock. When I came into this program, sort of for the first 3 years, I did what I was told because I didn't have anywhere else to go and I didn't know anything else. At my third year anniversary exactly, I remember I had been seeing a therapist, I had been in group therapy, I had been in aftercare, one-on-one psychiatry, plus the meetings. And I had a sponsor, and at my third anniversary, I was so despondent and so sad and unhappy that I just wanted to be hit by a truck. And somebody said to me, you know, I want you to meet this person because she'll help you out. Turns out that this person was half my age, she had half my sobriety, but she said, you know what, I'll take you through the book and I will help you, I will help you, you will become happier. And I started coming to the Atlantic Group back then. And I did what she told me and I went through the steps. I didn't feel it, but you know what, we're told to act as if. And eventually what happens here goes into our hearts and into our beings. My life got busy then, and I got a job, a career started to take off, and I remember saying to this person, well, you know, I'm really ready for a relationship now. This is my favorite part. And she says to me, yes, you are. Now you need a sponsee. And I was like, not quite. When I got my sponsee, I have to tell you that that is what started softening my edges, and that's what started bringing me into the human race, integrating me into the community, because what I said to her, I had to practice. I wanted to help her. I didn't want to be fired. It's like, oh, my God, you know, the whole world's fired me, every friend, relative, whatever. You know, I can't have, you know, someone here firing me. So I took a lot of care to cultivate this relationship and to try and be as sincere as I could. And I grew, and I grew, and I grew to be more loving, to be kinder. Lo and behold, I got a relationship. I met somebody that was in these rooms, and he and I were together for 6.5 years, and he got cancer. And he died 1 year and 2 months ago. We were no longer together at that time. But I have to say that after we broke up and he still had his cancer, there was nowhere else I wanted to be but to help him through, because I was the closest person to him. It wasn't his kids and it wasn't his ex-wife. Somehow it was me. And I was able to watch this person die and to take him through it, something that I never in a million years dreamed I could do. And I sat there, and that's where I wanted to be. And when he died, the rooms carried me. People helped me. And I kept coming to meetings. I kept sharing about it. And I had a lot of comfort, and I had a lot of people around me. And I prayed. And my God helped me. This was 1 year ago in November. Last June, I went on a spiritual retreat. I didn't know it was a big book study, but I went to the Bill Wilson House, and it was a big book study put on by the Atlantic Group. And I was thrilled to be there. But what really clinched it, and by the way, after my first stint at Atlantic Group, I stopped coming here, and basically the problem was is that I never really did a 10th step, so I wasn't current with where I was. And I had a lot of little things in me that were, like, annoying me. And that's why I wanted to come to this, because I needed to reconnect better with God and to start working more of a program. I came in, I'm there, this one guy, Kevin H., starts talking about the bedevilments. You know, if you're sitting in here, you know, you are sober, but if you're unhappy, you can't have a relationship, you're miserable, you're jealous, you're angry, you don't have to be that way. You can have more. And I was like, that's me. You know, I'm signed up. I'll take it. So since June, I have been coming here very, very regularly, and I got myself a sponsor who sees me through doing the program, and I have to do it. It's not a sponsor that's like, oh, you know, maybe. I have to do it every day. I have to pray. I have to report to her, Peggy, and I couldn't be happier about it. So I just want to say that I am eternally grateful to be sober, and thank you all.
Speaker tonight is TJ.
Thank you. Hi, family. My name's TJ, and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Spiritual Solutions meeting in Sag Harbor. And until tonight, I used to think it was the best meeting on the eastern end of the U.S. I said, until tonight, this is quite a meeting. This is amazing. There's a lot of people here. I'm sober 19 years. A little over 19 years ago, I remember my sixth night down in the basement of this very building. It was the Midtown meeting. It was my first Thirsty Thursday. And I thought if I could just get through this Thursday night and get a week, there might be hope for me. And I remember there was a speaker, and then they broke into groups. And I remember being at a table, and I was pounding the table with my fear of drinking. It was like I was holding my seat in the chair, afraid that I was going to run out and drink. And I didn't. I remember, though, as I was pounding, somebody at the next table kind of looking over at me, concerned. And then some people from that meeting took me over to the 79th Street workshop. And then from that meeting, I think we got a bite to eat at a diner, and then we went to the midnight meeting in Times Square. And I had done I'd gone to the mustard seed meeting before I went to the meeting in the basement here. So by 1 o'clock in the morning, I was pretty exhausted, and I went home. And I remember when I woke up the next morning, I said, yes, I made it, a week. You know, I couldn't wait to get to a meeting and get my 7-day applause. Those applauses meant a lot to me. You know, I come from a very long line of alcoholics, and I've heard people say that, you know, alcoholism's genetic. I've heard people say it's environmental. In either case, I was set up from the very beginning. My father was an alcoholic. His mother was an alcoholic. On my mother's side, my grandmother had 7 brothers and 7 sisters. Big Irish family. Every single one of them died from alcoholism. So I was set up before I picked up my first drink. All the alcoholic attitudes were laid down for me. My family has a long history of alcoholism and a long history of trouble with the law. You know, a lot of petty crimes. My grandfather had done time in a reform school. My father had done time in a reform school. My older brother had done time in a reform school. And I, like the rest of my family, I kind of went in the family business, you know? It's not like we were an organized crime family. If anything, we were a disorganized crime family. It was a lot of pathetic stuff. And a lot of my trouble was always around drinking. I was 17 and I'd already lost my driver's license. In fact, I remember when the cop pulled me over and he asked me for my license, I handed him my paper license. You know, you got your paper license and the picture license would come in the mail. And I remember he just looked at me and thought, oh. And I lost my license. I, you know, I was one of those kids that always got caught for everything I ever did. You know, as a friend of mine from Brooklyn said, you know, I was always the cockroach in the middle of the kitchen when somebody turned the light on. You know? I never should have done anything wrong. I was at a party, and I had a few drinks, and I was walking home. And as I was walking home, I found this toy gun in a field. And, you know, I picked it up, and I was playing with it, and I was twirling it around my finger and sticking it in my pocket. You know, I was kind of an immature 17-year-old. If somebody had seen me doing it, I would have stopped, you know? It was just, I was kind of at that age. And as I walked through the parking lot of this Farmer Jack's, I grew up in the Midwest, there was one of those photo mat booths, you know, the places where you drive up and drop your film off and come back and get it the next day. And I walked up to the window with the little toy gun and stuck it in the window, and I said, your money or your life, or, you know, something really stupid like that. And the woman turned, and she scooped out $50 from the cash register. And I grabbed it, and I ran home. And I got caught. It didn't matter that it was a toy gun, and the judge wasn't amused. And I got sent to an adult prison at 17 years old for 4.5 to 15 years. So my consequences for my drinking and behavior hit early. On my first day when I was in prison, there were some older inmates befriended me, and they said, do you drink, kid? I said, oh, like a fish, you know, which fish is what they called new inmates as well, you know. And he says, well, we make our own liquor here. You know, we make spud juice. Some prisons call it Pruno. And I thought, oh, boy, I'll get through this time real fast. And so I sat down with these guys, and I had a drink. And it was nasty. It was like, oof. I just can't even begin to tell you what it tasted like, but that warmth started to come up from the first drink. And at a certain point, I had turned my head, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw the guys refilling my glass. I thought, well, they just think it's cute, you know, getting the young fish drunk, you know. So I kept turning my head, you know. I was young and naive, and you know, I'm an alcoholic. I couldn't see beyond the drink. I couldn't see what was coming. What I didn't know was these guys spiked my drink with Thorazine, which is a heavy sedative they gave the mentally ill prisoners. And then I was lured down the hall and gang raped. And when the guys were done, they literally flipped a coin in the air to decide which of them would own me. And I became the property of another inmate. Needless to say, while I was in there, every opportunity that I got to drink or to drug, I did. Because I didn't want to be there. I wanted to check out. I didn't want to feel, and I didn't want to experience. And, you know, there was no escape other than alcohol. I got out of prison at 21, literally got out of prison on a Monday, and I flew to New York on a Friday. I wanted to put as much distance between me and that world as I possibly could. I even changed my name on the plane. What I learned in these rooms years later, though, is that the problem with a geographic is that you take you with you. And I brought my demons with me, and as much as I tried to outrun them, they were right behind me the whole time. And I drank, and I checked out as much as I could. But I'll tell you this, I was never going to do anything that was going to get me landed back in prison again. That much was sure, was certain. But I love New York. New York offered a lot of anonymity. You know, it was a new world. You know, nobody knew me. I didn't have that past to overcome, and I was young enough. I was 21. And I remember when I arrived here, there was someone I met who told me, oh, New York's great. You know, the bars are open until 4 a.m., then there's the after-hours clubs. And whenever I talked to anybody back home, and they'd say, how's New York? It'd be the first thing I'd say. The bars are open until 4 a.m., and there's after-hours clubs. They're legal. The bars are only open until 2 in Detroit. I love that. There was work here. You know, and I got work here, and I stayed out of trouble, but every opportunity I got, I drank. I stumbled into the New York City Transit Authority. And in fact, when I got sober, I came into AA at 27. And in fact, that next morning when I woke up and went to work, that was the first five-day work week I had put in about 2 months. I was this close from getting fired from the New York City Transit Authority. You all live in New York. You have any idea how bad you got to be that close to getting fired? I was out of control, you know? And my magic wasn't working for me anymore. My world was very small. My world was very isolated. That film, what's that movie? I See Dead People. Sixth Sense. You remember the kid sees ghosts, you know, but at a certain point in the film, he kind of stops and he turns around and he goes back into the tent where there's a ghost, and he sits down and he says, okay, do you have something you want to tell me? That's kind of what happened to me almost from the moment I walked into AA. You know, I'd been running, you know, my whole life, it seemed. But certainly from 21 to 27, I'm going to skip here because, I just we've heard the stories before. Bright lights, big city, I found drugs that enabled my drinking, and, you know, all those days that I would miss work, and the promises I'd make to myself at 8 o'clock in the morning as I was crashing, God, get me through this and I'll never do it again, and, you know, the trips to the ATM to get more cash, and, you know, the credit card debt up to here, and my world had been reduced to being in a sex club at, 6 in the morning, alone, with an empty bottle, you know, and then I would stagger home. So I staggered into these rooms, I staggered into the mustard seed, and I felt like I was sliding off of a roof, and I couldn't hold on anymore, and I wanted to let go. And, where I started, I'd rather die than go back there. So AA was my last choice or my last chance. And I staggered in, and the people in the rooms embraced me. You know, they said, you're in the right place. You know, come early and stay late. Sit in the front row. And raise your hand and share your day count. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Get a sponsor, someone who's got what you want. And do what he did to get what he's got, what he has. The men stick with the men, and the women stick with the women. All the lessons that I learned in these rooms were almost the exact opposite of the lessons that I learned growing up, you know, and I had been living my life by. And there was hope. I don't know for what. It just, if it was nothing else than to, you know, avoid going back to where I had been. But I took the suggestions, and my life started to change almost immediately. I had a sponsor in the software business, and they said, find someone who's got what you want and do what they did. He had a duplex apartment with a garden apartment. You know, I remember being in his apartment once and looking around going, God, if I do what you did, could I get what you got, you think? Maybe? You know. I went to college in recovery, and I got my bachelor's degree at St. Francis College, which was around the corner from my home group at the time. When I graduated, there were 26 people in the balcony from my home group who came to watch me get my diploma. And they held a meeting up there. Graduations can be pretty pretty boring, you know, waiting until the one person you know out of hundreds gets up and walks across the stage. So they held a meeting about showing up for each other. And my sponsor had a party for me after that. And, you know, I did what my sponsor did, and I stumbled into the software business. And I did it at a time that was great to get into that business. And, you know, my world changed, you know, on the outside. I did my, I did the steps, and I remember when I got done doing the my fifth step with my sponsor, he said to me, you know, TJ, you might want to consider therapy. You know, I said, you think? He says, well, you got one or two things in your background that, you know, you might benefit from that. I used to hang out a lot at the diner in Brooklyn Heights, where all the people after the meeting would go. And I remember being there that one night with a lot of my friends that I counted days with and that. And I said, you know, my sponsor said I should maybe go to therapy. You think I need it? And everybody at the table's head just vigorously went up and down, you know. I said, oh, okay. You know, I wasn't ready to talk about any of my stuff, really. I mean, it was a big deal for me to share what I shared with my sponsor in my fifth step. But I felt this enormous relief in doing it. You know, I'd been carrying this burden around. I'd been carrying these secrets around with me. Things that I thought I would never tell another soul. They'd go to my grave with me. You know, what happened in there stayed in there. And I think even with my sponsor, I sort of just danced around it a little bit, but I probably shared enough with him for him to know that enough of to get a glimpse of what it was like for me in there. And I, you know, for many of us, we need other things. We need help outside the steps, but the steps were certainly a huge catalyst for me to begin the real work of recovery. And even the word recovery, I think that, you know, I learned a whole new life in these rooms. And the program opened up possibilities for my life that I wouldn't have had. You know, I think it's a miracle that I've even lived this long, frankly. I wanted to die. The way that I was drinking and doing other things, I think I've heard somebody say in the rooms once, I was doing suicide on the installment plan. You know, I lacked the nerve to just do it directly, you know. And in here I was taught to, you know, face my demons and to recover from it. I know the first time having gone through the steps, doing the fourth and the fifth step, I remember there were times, even without getting to the really heavy stuff with my sponsor, my face burning when I would share some of the things that I had done, you know. And I had a great sponsor that would say, I've done that, you know. All through the way, he was like, yeah, I've done that too. You know, and each time he did that, I would feel a little less unique, you know. A little less different, a little less terminally unique, I guess, you know, a little more human. Sixth and the seventh step took a couple times through, and I'm still working on that. My character defects reveal themselves to me in layers, and I still have work to do there. But the eighth and the ninth step, the making the list of people that I owed amends to, was so important, you know, to take that action and to try to make right. And in some cases, the best amends I could do was to stay out of somebody's life, you know. Each time I did one of those things, it sort of made me feel a little more human, a little less unique, I started to give myself a little bit of a break. It was about learning how to be comfortable in my own skin 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was about learning how to be able to look people in the eye, which I couldn't do. I still use that as a gauge for how I'm working my program. If I'm finding that I'm looking down a lot and I can't look people in the eyes, it's sort of, I'm like, okay, what's going on here? You know, why am I isolating? My disease wants me alone and it wants me dead. But I did that work in my, and I continue to do that work. I continue to do service. I had a problem at a certain point in my sobriety because things were going so great that when I was living in the material world, we talk about, this being a bridge back to life. I had a period where things were so great I couldn't make meetings because I was so busy, you know. I had a big job, and I had a place in the city and a house in the country, and, you know, my partner and I adopted a daughter, and, you know, I was juggling all these things, and I get to one meeting a week, and, and all of a sudden my attitudes were all over the place. I'd find out I was, you know, blowing up at a hotel clerk, you know, or at a car rental reservationist. The very thing that had given me this life, I've heard people say that anything you put in front of your sobriety, you'll lose. And I have stayed sober for all this time, but I've not drank or drugged, I should say. But I haven't stayed sober. There was a period there where I wasn't sober. I hadn't picked up, but I wasn't sober. And I hit another spiritual crisis. It's a great thing about my disease and higher power. You know, he's got a good sense of humor. I heard somebody say once, you know, it'll start with a whisper, and then he'll do a tap, and then he goes off and he gets a bat. You know, and I'm tired of getting beat up by that bat, I got to tell you. And it brought me back to the rooms again. But I got to a point where I was hating my life. I was stressed. I was traveling, and I was going to meetings again. And in my 11th step, the meditation meeting on Sunday mornings, I go to. We meditate and we chant beforehand, and we do a meditation for 20 minutes. It was good. And I kept getting this pulse or this sort of message. You know, the 11th step is really about asking higher power's will for us, and the power to carry that out. I kept getting tugged. You know, HP said, you know, your life is miserable in this area for a reason, because you need to be somewhere else, you know? And I was very reluctant to go there. I had, all these prizes, I guess, from this new life that HP and these rooms and had given me, but I was being drawn back into prisons, you know, and I kept getting this message saying, you know, you need to write about it. You know, it was very clear. I saw some telepsychic, John Edwards on TV, you know. He'd always come out and there'd be a galley of people, and he'd come out there and he'd say, okay, I'm coming over here. And then he'd start channeling, and sure enough, in this area, there'd be somebody that, you know, these details he was throwing out, it was kind of like that for me. You know, it was like I just kept getting pulled over here saying, you got to do this. And I remember actually sitting outside of my therapist's office, writing in my journal about this, saying, you know, it's becoming clearer and clearer that this is what I need to be doing, but I'm frightened and I'm not sure. And, you know, what do you mean I'm supposed to write? You know, I've never written before, and I don't, you know, I know I have a story, but... and then I said, you know, God, I'd like to do it. I need help getting started. And I swear, on my way home, I swear to God, in fact, I shared this that Sunday at my meditation meeting. On that way home, there was this kooky lady standing on the corner hitchhiking. And I pulled over, and, you know, it was in East Hampton. You don't see hitchhikers in East Hampton, right? So I picked her up, and she's chatting a mile a minute, and as we're driving, she's, you know, what do you think I do? I says, oh, I don't know. She says, well, take a guess. I was like, I don't know, you're a therapist? She says, no, I'm a teacher. And I says, you know, I was going to say that. And she says, a lot of people do that. And I go, what do you teach? She says, writing. And then she volunteered. She says, I'll tell you what, for giving me a ride, I'll give you 3 free lessons. And I took them. And someone in the room, Big Hair Lynn, if some of you guys might know her from this area, she got me into a writer's workshop. And, you know, it was like I got to this place where it was like, okay, I give up, I'll do it. And I went back to prison, and I wrote about what happened to this 17-year-old kid, this kid from an alcoholic family, the drunk that couldn't see beyond a drink. And I finished that book, and miraculously it was published. And I released it, or it got released through publisher a couple months ago, and I've been out promoting it. And, you know, it's been amazing. I'll never make what it cost me to do it, because I quit my job, and I just did it because it's what my higher power said I had to do, share my experience, strength, and hope. It's what I've learned how to do in these rooms, which is be of service to others. What the promises tell us that we'll no longer regret the past, nor wish to close the door on it, that no matter how far down the path we may have gone, others can benefit from that service. So I've done that. I've been to Harvard, Columbia, Howard, American, UCLA. I've been to jails. I'm delighted to hear that this group sponsors 28 meetings a month at Rikers Island. You know, we have 2.2 million prisoners in this country, more than any other country in the world. And this is an astonishing number. 13.5 million people passed through the criminal justice system last year. And if you talk to anybody in corrections, they'll tell you that 95% of them have alcohol and drug problems. Our prisons and jails are the world's largest rehabs without a treatment plan. And my higher power has taken me back there. I was in a jail in San Francisco. Actually, the sheriff, Mike Hennessy, sent his chief of staff to come pick me and Barbara up from my home group. She came out with me. And, I had the privilege of speaking in front of a group of inmates there. And the guys asked me, what was my first step in dealing with my the trauma of my sexual abuse? And I said, the first step was getting sober. And it absolutely was. The first step for a whole new life for me was getting sober. 19 years ago, when I walked into the mustard seed, and on my sixth day, when I came here and pounded the table and the people took me to those other meetings. There's nothing in my life that I can't draw a line back to these rooms. Nothing. Even my partner tomorrow will have 14 years. I met him at a Roundup dance. And we've been together 14 years, and I love him very much. And he's sober. When I met him, he had 5 years. I had 5 years. We were both in therapy, and I thought, oh. Gave us a lot of hope, I got to tell you. You know, that's two amazing sets of tools to, you know, build a relationship. Because so much of the work that we do is about, you know, relationships with ourselves, with God, and another human being, you know? I wouldn't have gotten any of these lessons in my family of origin. And the rooms of AA are my family, you know? This is my family. This is home for me. And I hope you like what you're doing with me, because it's pretty amazing, you know? It's an amazing life. So thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for letting me speak tonight.